Welcome to Today on Broadway for Thursday, April 28th, 2016. I'm Broadway World's Matt Tamanini.
And I am Broadway Star's James Marino.
Wait, who are you? Just kidding. Welcome back, James. I know we've been without you for a couple days. I think the natives who are listening were getting a little restless, but you did see American Psycho and Waitress, right?
I did. I saw Waitress last night and American Psycho on Monday night, and I tell you, it's really amazing what this season is closing in with. There's some really great shows.
I assume you'll have full reviews on this week on Broadway on Saturday?
Sunday.
So what did I say?
You said Saturday.
Whatever.
So, yes. And in fact, both evenings, Michael Portantier and I sat merely feet apart in different rows. And most interesting last night at Waitress was Jesse Tyler Ferguson was there. And we were like, wait, his show just opened up. But he was dark on Tuesday night, which is strange. Yeah. But he was at Waitress on Tuesday night.
Did you say hello? Ask him if he wants to host a podcast?
Yeah. You know, I told him, you know, he said that he had sent you an email, Matt, at matt@broadway.com. And we're getting a lot of those emails.
We are. We are kind of a little overwhelmed by how many people want to be involved with what we're putting together here with the expanded Broadway Radio Network. So Jesse Tyler Ferguson and anybody else, if I haven't responded to you, I will. We are going through them all and just trying to figure some things out between us. But if you still want to get involved with Broadway Radio, send me an email at matt@broadwayradio and james@broadwayradio.com.
We are going to look at everybody's emails and get back to you no matter what. We like making spreadsheets.
Yes, we do.
All right. So let's get on to Long Day's Journey into Night. It opened on Broadway.
It did. Last night, the fifth Broadway revival of Eugene O'Neill's semi-autobiographical play, Long Day's Journey into Night, opened at the American Airlines Theater. This 3-hour and 45-minute roundabout revival features a literally unbelievable cast. It's led by Oscar and Emmy winner Jessica Lange as Mary, Tony nominee Gabriel Byrne as James, and playing their sons Jamie and Edmund are Academy Award nominee Michael Shannon and Tony winner John Gallagher Jr. Jonathan Kent directs, and the production is presented in association with Lange's American Horror Story boss Ryan Murphy. And it's interesting to note that, as NBC New York's Robert Kahn points out, Lange was nominated for an Olivier playing Mary in 2000, and Byrne was nominated for a Tony playing an older version of Jamie in O'Neill's Moon for the Misbegotten that same year. This play, which O'Neill only allowed to be produced posthumously, tells the story of the Tyrone family as they battle addiction, guilt, and long-held resentments. The Hollywood Reporter's David Rooney writes that as dark and emotional as the show is, this production features a lot of kind of nervous laughter, he says. He writes, much of the acrid humor that keeps bubbling up comes from Michael Shannon's dangerously unpredictable Jamie Tyrone, the unrepentantly cynical eldest son. But the heat-seeking center of the production is Lange's morphine-addicted Mary Tyrone. An edge of insanity electrical current runs through much of Lange's work. It's that attraction to madness that gives this performance such mesmerizing authority. Adam Feldman of Time Out New York says, Jessica Lange brings stunning colors to the role of a woman clawing her way through fog. You can't take your eyes off her. It's a mesmeric performance. Lange's Mary is a desperate fighter, defensive and manipulative, but by turns, she is loving, wistful, lonely, proud, vicious, and confused. But above all, she is an addict. He goes on to say that Gabriel Byrne plays her husband James with striking weariness and restraint. He also adds that Shannon is riveting as Jamie and that John Gallagher Jr. is willfully sincere as Edmund. Jeremy Gerard from Deadline continues with the raves, writing, by the time this journey was done, I was completely given over to the dark and dangerous spell of O'Neill's masterpiece. It was as though I was seeing it for the first time. This would have been impossible without one of the rarest convergences on Broadway, an all-star cast and director that works as well on stage as they promised on paper. I'm sure we'll have the New York Times review on tomorrow's show, but James, I know you're seeing this on Saturday, so I'm really excited to hear what you have to say on Sunday, but these seem to be the best reviews for a play of the spring season though this far, don't they?
You know, I'm wondering if we can compare them against The Humans, and The Humans seems to be an updated version of this, and we'll see what happens, but it's a power, you know, the underlying property is so well known and such a great property and a great cast, and the Tyrone family as they battle addiction, guilt, and long-held resentment sound like Thanksgiving at my house.
I'm very sorry to hear that, James.
And so I am going Saturday evening at 7 o'clock, and it is 3 hours and 45 minutes, and my wife has told me that she might back out at the last second. So if you're in New York City, email me, and I'll take you to the show if she cancels on me. Yeah. All right, let's go up to Tuck Everlasting, the reviews that you didn't get yesterday.
Yeah, yesterday I went through some of the reviews for the new musical Tuck Everlasting, which opened on Tuesday night, but I wanted to make sure that I got in some of the later ones because, as has been a theme this spring, and maybe even longer, the New York Times has been a bit of an outlier on a lot of these. While most of the reviews for Tuck were mixed at best, that old gray lady and critic Charles Isherwood gave it a solid rave. Isherwood wrote, "Family-friendly musicals on Broadway generally come in just one flavor, flashy. Enter Tuck Everlasting, a warm-spirited, piercingly touching musical that has nothing flashy or splashy about it." He continues, saying that the musical rings a variation on the Fountain of Youth myth, ultimately asking what life would mean if it never ended, and whether a never-ending life would be worth living. It also provides an answer in an enthralling, wordless climax, a ballet that depicts with moving clarity what another, much-celebrated musical would call the circle of life. Likewise, Newsday's Linda Wina praised the show, saying, "From the small world of unexpected pleasures comes Tuck Everlasting, a gentle but hardly lightweight fantasy musical about an 11-year-old girl and the prospect of eternal life. This touching, low-tech show is for an underserved niche audience, families who want to be thoughtfully charmed for a few hours after being hyper-entertained by Wicked and Matilda." James, you're much closer to this than I am, but it seems to me that for most of this spring season, the New York Times has been almost completely at odds with the critical consensus. I mean, have you noticed that? And what does that mean for the waning importance for what the Times review means, whether it's a positive or a negative review?
Well, I think that the only thing that we can say is consistent about the New York Times is that we can't predict what they're going to say, whether it be Brantley or Isherwood. It's been harder and harder to gauge beforehand what they are going to think about these things. And you talk about the waning influence. I tell you, there's a bubble that producers and press reps live in that believe that the Times Review is the end all. Still, they believe this, and I don't know. I mean, they must have the numbers that back that up, but see it.
I don't know. I think Jason Robert Brown and Tony Danza would beg to differ, because we've seen a lot of shows get rave reviews from the New York Times that other people didn't review as well and that people just didn't latch on to. So I'm not sure. I think obviously getting a good review from the Times is always a badge of honor that any show would love to have, but I'm not sure that it carries as much weight as it did in generations past.
Hey, if you love Vegas...
I didn't see the show, but I love the cast recording, and I love Bryn O'Malley, so I like that. I would have seen it.
I saw Honeymoon in Vegas at Paper Mill, and if I had $1 million, I would have given it to Jason Robert Brown, and I would be $1 million poorer, because I can't believe that show didn't make it. I loved Honeymoon in Vegas. And, well, you know, I'm a big Jason Robert Brown fan, so... I'm a bit skewed there, but I really loved it. And I love Bridges of Madison County too, but
Broadway's a fickle business.
It is. If we knew what was going to run, you and I'd be yacht racing, wouldn't we?
I've heard you say that a few times, James.
Yes, we're working on that. So, Hairspray Live.
Yeah, it seems like every day this week, it actually has been every day this week, we've had more news coming out of the upcoming December production of NBC's Hairspray Live. Usually we have to wait until May's upfronts to get some of this news. But yesterday we learned that Tony winner Martin Short will
that
be playing...
Canadian?
That he is Canadian, but he will be playing the loving husband Wilbur Turnblad opposite Harvey Fierstein's Edna in the show this December. And despite original link Matthew Morrison throwing his hat into the ring for the part, Emmy winner and former New York Spring Spectacular star Derek Huff will be playing TV host Corny Collins. Word also came out this week that in addition to broadcasting from multiple locations at Universal Studios in L.A., Hairspray Live will also feature a kind of live audience. Reports are that fans will be used more as extras than as a traditional audience, but as I have written numerous times after these live events on Broadway World, any form of audience for the performers to interact with, especially in an energetic comedy like Hairspray, would be an improvement to what they've done in the past. And I think it's pretty clear that Neil and Craig and Bob and Kenny Leon are really upping their game from a production standpoint after the success of Fox's Grease Live in January.
I wonder, you know, I guess the Peter Pan thing, we could have done Hunch to Lost Boys as an interactive thing.
We don't speak of Peter Pan Live, James.
Oh, I liked Peter Pan Live.
It was totally fine.
Okay. So what's happening in the casting and show news?
Well, yesterday the full cast was rounded out for the upcoming UK production of Harold Pinter's No Man's Land, which will star Sirs Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart, who will play Spooner and Hurst, respectively. Mm-hmm. Joining the regular collaborators will be Damian Maloney, a regular on British TV, as Foster, and Owen Teal as Briggs. The production, directed by Sean Mathias, will tour in the UK beginning on August 3rd, before starting a limited engagement at London's Wyndham's Theatre on September 8th. The production will be a revival of sorts of the version that Mathias, McKellen, and Stewart worked on together on Broadway in 2013 and 14 that ran in rep with Waiting for Godot. James, are you a Godot fan? Or are you a Godot fan? Where do you stand on the whole pronunciation thing?
I was a Godot person, but then Patrick Stewart says Godot, so I have to go with Patrick Stewart. And Matt, please do what you can to bring this production to New York in next spring.
Well, I mean, it was just there 3 years ago. I don't know what else I can do if you didn't see it then. But but I do agree with you. I'm going to do whatever Dr. Xavier tells me to do when it comes to pronouncing the word Godot.
All right. So Whirl Inside a Loop, that Sherry Renee Scott vehicle.
Yeah. Yesterday, it was announced that a private industry reading of the Dick Scanlon and Sherry Renee Scott's play Whirl Inside a Loop would be held tomorrow, with Emmy-nominated Mad Men star Christina Hendricks taking on the role of the volunteer, which Scott originally played off-Broadway in 2015. Co-directed by Scanlon and Michael Mayer, the reading is expected to be a precursor to an upcoming Broadway run. Joining Hendricks in the reading will be Derek Baskin, Nicholas Christopher, Tyrone Davis Jr., Ryan Quinn, Daniel J. Watts, and Donald Weber Jr. All of these actors, except for Davis Jr., appeared in the second stage production last summer. James, we were talking before we started recording. You think this is a really good show, but maybe not something that's a likely commercial vehicle.
Yeah, the underlying property is amazing, and I would love to see it as a film. Insofar as making it a commercial theater run, I don't know if Broadway fans are going to buy tickets for this, but maybe it's being brought to Broadway for the prestige of being on Broadway, and maybe it's to get on the radar screen of the Pulitzers, or maybe it's for other reasons. But I don't know if this is going to – if this would make a ton of money on Broadway, but I'm glad to see it moving forward.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how the Pulitzers work, since it's already had a run, if it would qualify for the Pulitzers or not. But we know that a show having a Broadway run compared to an off-Broadway run dramatically influences the amount of regional productions that a show could have. And a small character drama like this could have a life after Broadway, regionally around the country. But either way, I think it's great that a show like this, which is really different than what we're used to seeing on Broadway, might get a run. And I saw Christina Hendricks in the concert production of Company a few years ago, and she was surprisingly strong on stage. So it'll be interesting to see what she can do in a role like this.
All right, what's next?
All right, there was another story yesterday about a show potentially making its way to Broadway, but this one was a little more decidedly off the beaten path than a Sherry Renee Scott play. This is a musical version of the kids' graphic novel series Diary of a Wimpy Kid that is currently playing at Minneapolis's Children's Theater Company. And according to the Minneapolis Star Tribune, a steady stream of New York and Hollywood muckety-mucks have been flying into the Twin Cities to check out the production, fueling speculation that Wimpy will land on Broadway. James, you have kids. Do they read these books?
Absolutely. These books are all the rage with the kids. And I really see that as
really?
A great source material. And I think that it's going to be, if they can bring SpongeBob in, they can bring Wimpy Kid.
That's true. All right. Well, I will take it on your authority that this would be a good property for a musical.
Absolutely. So what do we have in recommendations?
All right. As we are wont to do, I wanted to recommend a few videos for the listeners. The first is of a performance that I mentioned in yesterday's show, and that is the best presentation winner from Monday's Easter Bonnet competition, Hamilton's reworked opening number, which now attends to the tale of Sweeney Todd. It actually, James, I'm going to be honest with you, it kind of makes me angry. It makes me really, really angry because there is no reason that Lin-Manuel Miranda should be able to, with everything else going on in his life, winning a Pulitzer, you know, owning Broadway, releasing a book, being on Time Magazine's Top 100, then be able to write really funny, intricate lyrics about Sweeney Todd to the most famous song in his show. It's not fair. It is not fair that he hogs all the genius, but it's really funny. So whether you love Hamilton or Sweeney Todd or both or neither, watch it because it's really, really cool.
You know how he does that?
Never sleeps because he goes nonstop.
Nonstop.
Or he writes like he's running out of time.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord. All right. The other video I wanted to mention is a post-show disaster relief performance benefiting Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS still, even though the Easter Bonnet competition is over. And that's from Aaron Tveit and Carrie Butler, who reunited after a performance of Disaster to sing the song Seven Wonders from Catch Me If You Can. As much as I loved that Hamilton Sweeney Todd video, this one might be my favorite because I loved Catch Me If You Can, and I was really sad that it didn't have a better life on Broadway. And when I saw it, Carrie was out of the show and an understudy who was also great, but you know, it wasn't Carrie Butler. So it was cool to see them do the song together. And then the final one, which I think is also very, very cool, following their appearance together at the Easter Bonnet competition, rock and roll queen Stevie Nicks did an encore with the kids of School of Rock to the classic Fleetwood Mac song Rhiannon. Now, James, I think that's a band that if we're trying to brainstorm bio musicals and jukebox musicals, Fleetwood Mac seems, both from a catalog and a drama perspective, to be one that might actually work.
Yeah. I mean, they've got it's going to be one of those things where people are going to be like, oh, they wrote that one. Oh, they did that one. Oh, they did, you know.
Or they say from the script, no way that happened. That couldn't have happened in real life. All of those people hooking up and stuff, that could never have happened.
All right, Matt, why don't you get us out of here?
All right, thanks for listening to Today on Broadway. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Broadway Radio. And you can find me on Twitter at BWWMatt. And subscribe to Some Like It Pop on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play.
And I am James Marino from BroadwayRadio.com and BroadwayStars.com. Thank you for continuing to listen and give us your feedback. And we will talk to you tomorrow.